sorry, you were saying, Donnie?
Yeah, I'll get back to it. Well, I could say something about that. Yeah, you want that again?
Yeah, you want to open with that?
Can summarize it?
Even,
yeah,
that's not even have an intro. We're just going to, people have been craving the pod. I'm going to waste no time. Yeah. Let's just jump right in. What were you
saying? I've been having trouble with attending any Twitter spaces. Okay, preface, 2020, 2021, I felt the same way, except I was a new participant in that time frame. Every space that I got into, there were like 1,000 listeners. There was some like what I would refer to now as a cabal of people who like everybody knew, and they were all up top yelling at each other about nothing constantly for like a year. And you could never get on stage to put a reasonable take up. And if you did, you got kicked off immediately. So that was a bad taste in my mouth. Ordinals came around in 2023. And or like at the launch of the protocol, maybe my launch of it anyway, in like February-ish, every space for like 8 months was just talking about the new tech, the new possible use cases, and all the artists that were like putting shit on chain and what was going to happen when they did. And it was fun and uplifting. And in 2024, probably just pre-rune season, everyone got price speculative. And it was constantly about what was costing what. Now that everybody's bags are in, they're all just yelling at each other because they have nothing else to do. There's like they've lost their interest in the tech because they feel like the opportunity for 1,000x is maybe not there anymore. And it's just yelling over each other. And I've lost my passion to attend those spaces because what I showed up for to begin with is just kind of not there. So I just woke up on the wrong side of the bed today.
I feel you, Donnie. I mean, kind of similar vibes here. I only really recently started hopping in spaces occasionally. One day, hang out with a couple friends on Friday. And then two, now we have a few new things happening in the Bitcoin layered scheme world, which are fun to talk about. But things like, it's not like I'm even like that excited about these specific things. They just represent a new type of conversation to have, which does border on the technical, which I find interesting. So yeah, but it's been about 4 months of a very I want to put this
vitriolic
in, actually. Well, it's just been like pretty empty conversation.
I was just telling my mother that this morning. I was walking back from the gym and I was calling her because I talked to her every day on the way home from the gym. And she was like, so is there anything? I said I was going to be on this. And she said, is there anything interesting happening on Bitcoin right now? And I was like, kind of. If you zoom out, it's all really interesting because it's all going towards a thing that might end up doing something really cool. But on an individual level, each one of these things has its own like sub issues that I am or am not as interested in. But the general idea of development and pushing forward on Bitcoin is like thrilling to me. But yeah, there's something happening on Bitcoin.
Hold on. You just said you call your mom every time you leave the gym. You are like
sometimes
the
when
best
I'm walking there,
son
too.
Ever, yeah. Dude.
You're the best son ever. That's awesome.
I'd call my dad, but he doesn't pick up. He doesn't care about the phone. He's one of those people tape it to him. You know?
Do you go to the gym once a year or are you like on a regular basis?
No, it's like 5 days a week. I talk to my mom every day.
Like he goes to the gym every day, twice a day probably.
Lately, I've been there a lot. Yeah, it feels good.
That's impressive. On the topic, though, I will say there's something about, and you see this whenever you spend time in like a smaller ecosystem, like this has happened in Stacks for sure, where there's like, you buy the token, so there's like, you know, price speculation, and there's like hope on the other side. And when hope starts to fade, things just get so bad so fast. And it's like, small pie, I want to take my slice, and it just becomes like fighting. I think that's what's going on in Runes and Ordinals right now. It's like, everyone has like, got to get my slice. You know, fend for myself.
It's fear talking instead of love.
100%.
It was love a year ago. It's fear now. We'll get back to it.
Yep.
It'll happen.
Well, and I think, yeah, sorry, Jake. I was just going to comment on the growth of an ecosystem. When an ecosystem grows, you get more noise as more people with different backgrounds and different purposes for coming into the ecosystem start to, you know, and with the growing ecosystem, you naturally lose the early innovator technical conversations in what is like a broader conversation around, you know, the technology kind of is abstracted away into the background. And now we're going to talk applications and application layer and tokens. And so I agree with you, but at the same time, I think there can like, we're not going to stay technical forever. Like, As early innovators, I think if you look at the diffusion of innovation model, you gradually have this kind of innovator, early adopter, early majority, late majority. And I think that naturally, as ecosystems grow, you move away from the innovator talk, the more technical talk, into something that's more broadly applicable to other people. And so I'm not going to be as, I'm not going to like, you know, condemn the people running these spaces. I think it's valuable to kind of grow the ecosystem in this way. But I feel a little bit more foreign to those kinds of conversations because of how deeply I am rooted on the technical side.
I don't mean to condemn it. I just mean to say that it's the same people who used to be
I
having these
didn't.
like thoughtful, progressive, because I did, you're right. I came across that way. And I mean to say that it's the same people that I've been talking to for a year and a half who have now just all of a sudden, it's like their demons came out when they used to be like really excited about like what was going on. And now they're just like, hey, just give me the money. I got to get out of here. Just give me the
So
money.
we're coming up on a year of, I think, one of the events in the Ordinals, post-Ordinals narrative that caused me to start kind of repositioning how I want to talk about the space, and played a major role in me choosing to go into media, which is the Ordinals numbering debate. If you remember, this kicked off end of September, and I wrote a piece for Bitcoin Magazine, and I remember, like, I was very pro a solution where we did not prioritize numbers as they appeared on the website, or perhaps a middle ground solution where we grandfathered legacy numbers in, but we did not commit to number stability going forwards. But my big takeaway, as the ecosystem universally rejected that view, was that I think that began a trend where a lot of the early technical people in Ordinals found that it's not something that really interested them as much anymore. And I think it led to the reality, which is right now, which is the number of developers who are competent in the Ordinals and Ordinals adjacent type dev activities are limited. And I think that is the direct result of the community deciding to prioritize a more social
Whoa.
consensus layer than developer-focused reasonable layer. And the funny thing is, all my points about you're not going to care about numbers in the future, like this is what's going to happen is this.
They're happening.
I think this is the reality currently. So, my and I, it doesn't like doesn't like it. It just I just think it just means that it's a less ideal scenario than had we, I think, been more prudent and forethinking at the time. So,
I don't know
I
if I agree with that.
okay.
I agree with you that it was definitely more of a community consensus call and less of a developer friendly or like a programmer mindset change. But to say that that single-handedly resulted in less developer interest in the Ordinals protocol, I don't know about that.
Ooh, I think, yeah, I mean, I'm painting this narrative that I think it was the seminal moment which created a trend as people realized, well, this is not, you know, this the at the surface level is going to look a lot like just any kind of JPEG trend across NFTs, and this might not be something that super interests me. And then it also caused like Casey and Raf to have to add months and of extra work to try to reconcile, like kind of crowbarring the canonical order into the client. And I think that probably hamstrung like a lot of momentum, because the client became a lot more about like maintenance than it did like advancing interesting features.
They did
Yeah,
come up with a
people.
pretty elegant solution, though.
They did. They actually did.
Like I was a, you know, I had my initial opinions, but then when I heard the final solution, it actually feels like a pretty elegant solution for a developing, growing protocol. And so,
Yeah. They got a
yeah.
lot of shit for that too, though, remember? Because it was there was a lot of pushback on, are you trying to do the time chain ordering under our
Right.
noses? And so they got a lot of pushback on that too.
Right. You mean the
Yeah.
Jubilee idea that?
No, they added another field which basically tracked the inscriptions by like block by Bitcoin ordering, which it was another field they
Cool.
could use to like track just for their own sanity. But
Yeah.
it
Well,
wasn't
he
I
goes,
want to
that's
make
what
sure.
developers would want, right?
Yeah.
I want to make sure I understand. You're saying that when all this was happening, the vibes crowd, the plebs had outweighed say in how the protocol was changing, and that made the more technical people be a little skeptical long term. Is that the POV?
That's my argument. Yeah.
So
I think they just did. May I?
Yes.
Time sensitive. Can I? Sorry. I think they just did what we did with time. Like, what year is it? 2000. I genuinely don't know. 2024. So 2025 years ago, was it -1? No, we made this up. We track things the way we track them, and then there's reality beneath it. I think that Casey just did that, right?
The year actually depends on which country you live in.
Or religion, right?
Yeah.
The Christians won, though, because what do you write on checks, right?
Yeah. But it also depends, like, which country you live in, where the first Ordinal's Day is.
UTC.
Is it your local time? December 13th or 14th? Anyway, so.
Well, I think what's interesting about this is that there, I think that tracks, that I agree for the most part, but it's contrasted with, there's a ton of developer interest still. You just had some people kind of turn left, and I wonder if we're going to do that again with Opcat, because the people pushing Opcat are, like, there's a lot of consensus, but there's also a big cabal of people putting cat pics on Twitter, and I wonder if it gets pushed through in that way, it's also going to push a certain subset of highly technical people away. I could see that.
See, that's a good, I mean, I think that's a really good transition topic. I think both can be true, because Opcat doesn't have some kind of, like, it just, we have consensus about how it works within Bitcoin Script, but the implementations are multiple and varied. And they are pretty orthogonal, or even non-direct competing. Like a Lamport signature developer, people who are doing like Lamport signatures have nothing to do with people trying to crowbar like a DEX or an AMM, as it might be branded. So, I do think though, the past 2 weeks, man, have been wild because Opcat as a line item is just now thrown indiscriminately alongside other things. You have people like a poll that says, which are you more excited for? The Arch Network, Opnet, Opcat, Fractal, as if
apples,
they're like
oranges,
comparable things to like like these are four different options. They're like, no, they're all of these things are completely almost like entirely unrelated to each other. The closest you can get is Arch Network and Opnet. But like besides that, like these are entirely different things. So
yep. Okay.
Blast from the past.
Let's pivot. I want to talk Babylon because that was the hot news, probably the biggest news I think this week, because they went live on mainnet. Was it yesterday morning? It already feels like it was a long time ago, but it was yesterday morning where they blew up the blocks and they did the first 1,000 BTC was staked on the protocol, but they're not getting any yield currently. Yeah, in small increments, which is also pretty smart because you get a ton of usage and not just like one giant whale. But it's been in development for a long time. They have a ton of people building on it already, even though it's not live yet. So I don't know. What's your thoughts on this? This one's super interesting to me. I have a thesis that this is the way that ETH people are going to slowly move to Bitcoin without feeling like they're leaving ETH. So they're going to move from ETH to BTC but keep staking on ETH. So securing their mother chain, but they'll now be in the Bitcoin ecosystem, and they're just slowly coming home. Like, Babylon's a perfect way to vampire attack, is one way they'll call it, liquidity from ETH back to Bitcoin without it being a hard cut.
I think it's just an interesting scheme to solve certain issues with proof of stake. At a high level, like, that's the thing that interests me most, because I've always been neutral or agnostic about other consensus mechanisms. I'm a proof-of-work maxi, but I've always found proof of stake as an interesting consensus mechanism. It just has these structural issues of being technically permissioned, and like you have the asset itself being like a systemic risk to the consensus. And so if you use a different asset such as Bitcoin, then you can reduce some of that surface area for attack, which I think that's really cool. I like that. I haven't gone through, I don't really know like the game theory or the other challenges that may present, but I like it at a high level because I do think that the narrative that Bitcoin is this pristine asset has not been leaned into enough. What are your thoughts, Bob?
I did a thread on, you know, how it all works. And it's actually a really innovative solution on the Bitcoin staking side. So they do claim self-custodial staking. And the reason they can do that is because you lock it up just with, you know, with multiple spending paths. And once your time lock has expired, rather, or your staking duration, then you can withdraw yourself. No one else, you know, you don't need anyone else. It's just your private key. If you want to withdraw earlier than your time lock, then there is a Babylon committee multisig essentially. And it's a 2-of-2 multisig. You and Babylon can both agree, hey, I want to withdraw early. And if they let you, then you can't. So that's one way to get out. Then there's also a slashing path. The slashing path is like a 3-of-3 multisig between you, this Babylon committee multisig, and your destination staking chain. And that destination staking chain private key is essentially revealed in the case, it's like mathematically revealed in the case that you maliciously double sign on the proof of stake blockchain. And so that it exposes the destination chain key, and you have to provide your signature on the slashing path in order for your staking to be valid. And so then the Babylon committee multisig essentially has the power to, using your signature and the destination chain signature, to then slash your Bitcoin. So it's a really interesting way to slash for malicious behavior in a self-custodial staking mechanism.
Yeah, you're still trusting them to slash it, so, but which is a weird way to trust them to you know, enact the punitive measures of misbehavior. But
yeah, I would say the destination chain is trusting Babylon to slash. As a user, if you behave correctly, you know, you're a good participant in the proof of stake network, then you have a reasonably secure, assuming everything's been implemented correctly, secure way to stake your Bitcoin.
Do you think do you think it improves proof of stake? Do you think this is a material improvement to proof of stake or an actual compelling idea?
Yeah. I'm going to take a bit broader. I don't know if I should go broader or not. Essentially what it does is it adds an additional asset. So rather than just the native token staking, now you have what might be called cross-chain staking. So now you have a Bitcoin asset that is providing security to another chain. I view it kind of like some people call it shared security. You know, it's this restaking narrative. It's also kind of a way to like bootstrap a proof of stake chain. Because initially you want lots of assets, and so you need lots of capital. And if people can just take their Bitcoin and point it at your chain, then you can bootstrap up your security. But I view it mostly as like a bootstrapping mechanism for your chain rather than like really adding anything more in terms of the security standpoint. I kind of compare it to merge mining, actually, where if you can... if you can use merge mining, then you're bootstrapping the security of your network because you can use existing Bitcoin miner network to get more security, get more hash rate on your chain. But in the end, you're still trusting all of the Bitcoin miners themselves to not maliciously rug your sidechain. Like you don't really inherit any of the security of Bitcoin itself as a merged mine chain. You get the miners, and the miners can, you know, support your chain, but they don't have to support your chain. You don't get Bitcoin security. You just leverage the miners on Bitcoin. And in the same way, this shared security model, this restaking model, you're not inheriting the security of Bitcoin. You're just getting some security from the assets that have been staked toward your chain. Yeah.
Yeah, at some point you'd say, well, okay, if a proof of stake chain gets big enough, like then it becomes very expensive and difficult to buy your way into the chain way to attack it. Or for the smaller ones, like you got $20 million, you got $5 million in access to flash loan mechanisms.
Yep.
Like, yeah, you can long range attack this chain overnight.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. What's up, Don?
Could you do this with any asset then? Like, does it? Not like it shouldn't be Bitcoin, but like, could I just stake a ton of Kadena or a ton of Tronix or something, and it would have the same effect because it's a pre-existing asset? It's not really inheriting anything from Bitcoin. It's inheriting something from volume of money.
Yeah, it's this cross-chain staking idea. And so Babylon only does Bitcoin, but theoretically any asset, you know, could be used in this restaking narrative to secure proof of stake chains.
It is interesting with the token choice, because like you could use in proof of stake, you kind of have this like snake eats its own tail. It's all just like inclusive. So it does feel like just the rich get richer over time. But the external asset changes that dynamic, and Bitcoin is going to be the biggest glob of capital. It's going to grow over time. So it's not just as you stake, you're secured currently. It's like your security is decoupled from what your network is technically doing. So if Bitcoin booms, your network is now more secure, but you did nothing. That's pretty cool.
I totally get it. Yeah.
There's another angle here, which is there's a big argument that one of the reasons the Ethereum ETFs, TradFi World, have not taken off is because Ethereum is a yield-bearing asset. And if you have paper ETH on some ETF, you don't capture that yield. But Bitcoin, because it's not really been this yield-bearing asset, works really well. But if Bitcoin transitions to a yield-bearing asset as in addition to its current properties, maybe not natively yield-bearing, but yield-bearing just by virtue of being this pristine, desirable capital, like that could change some of the dynamics, if those dynamics are what are driving ETF inflows and outflows in any capacity. So this is an interesting like thing I'd be watching for.
Do you think on the miner side you can see, like, I could see a product where someone, you mine, the wallet destination that you're getting your rewards from goes straight to Babylon. You lock it up for a month, you get a little bit of yield, and then it comes back out. Like, on the miner side, does that make sense? Or is that just, like, a not worth the risk? Or
I could see that with any type of product, yeah. I wonder if miners are really going to... I don't know. My view is that miners should be selling all their Bitcoin pretty much soon after they mine it. It's my spicy opinion. Because I think... The miners should be in the business of capturing a margin on the commodity produced. But that would make sense. I guess the big question is our ecosystem ready for any kind of yield? Does the yield, where it comes from, and the security assumptions, is that worth it? Like in 2024 and 2025, do we have like institutional grade mechanisms to capture yield? And I'm unconvinced. So I do not take my own DCA'd, hard-earned DCA'd Bitcoin and try to capture any yield. I'm pretty like boilerplate Bitcoin maxi with that. I take, you know, some of my Bitcoin, and for just to keep myself intellectually curious and to participate in the degenerate world that is Bitcoin now, I go and buy shit. But like, yeah, I don't really think, I just think that if you're trying to chase much yield with any significant size of your Bitcoin stack, this is just, for the foreseeable future, going to be too risky. It's going to be, the risk outweighs the potential reward. But, like, are we going to see a future where it doesn't, where it is worth the risk? And I would anticipate, give us a few years, and I think we could probably get there.
Okay, I have a question for you, Charlie. We've chatted about this a bit via DM. I'm curious about Bitcoin yield generation mechanisms. So let's compare Bitcoin staking, you know, self-custodial staking in Babylon, securing proof of stake chains, and let's compare that to miners being able to essentially create a future hash rate contract and being able to earn yield. You know, people can earn yield on their Bitcoin in that fashion. Now compare these two yield generation mechanisms.
Yeah. So I actually think the hash rate, the synthetic hash rate derivative is probably the best type of yield product for Bitcoin. In fact, that's actually what Luxor was branding it initially as when they launched it. They got too much pushback on it, and probably some compliance and legal like hesitation for good reason. But I do think that, as far as I'm aware, is actually probably the best type of product that would do yield. So I think that's where the idle Bitcoin capital should be going, just from a strategic standpoint, I think it's actually probably worth the risk too right now, insofar as like I trust that, you know, this US-based US-regulated contract product actually you know, is pretty enforceable, and you can capture some decent like percent yield on it. So but Luxor probably smartly is not branding it as yield anymore because for obvious reasons.
Interesting.
I'm confused, but we're going to take a left turn anyways and change topics. Let's talk about Fractal. This has been a big topic also this week. You dropped a banger interview, Charlie, on Blockspace with Lorenzo.
I'm surprised he just like showed up on camera and talked. I think it's like the first like real Western interview. I think so.
You're out here breaking news with exclusives on Blockspace. If you're not tuned in, you're missing out. But yeah, this one's weird. Like, I don't know a ton. It's basically Bitcoin, except they have added Opcat, but everything else is basically vanilla. But they have some kind of like recursive where you could stack a bunch of nodes or something. Like, give us the TLDR that you've gleaned, and I'm sure Bob, have you done the thread? Give us the alpha.
Bob, have you looked through the node? Have you looked through their node, the GitHub?
Nope.
Okay, you should.
Yeah. Okay. I would say one way to explain Fractal is it is a Bitcoin sidechain. So separate chain, separate consensus, separate token, and separate miners, you know, everything. They do merge mine every third block. They call it cascade mining. So they'll mine two blocks. What, Charlie?
Cadence mining, same thing.
Oh, cadence, yeah. Another way to explain it is, you know, take pieces of all the existing Bitcoin sidechains and like smash them all together. So optionally, I think you can store a state root, like a hash on Bitcoin. Or, you know, they do merge binding, which makes it similar to something like Rootstock, or they leverage Bitcoin's code base, except they did add cat. So it could be viewed as like a really nice place for future Bitcoin developers to deploy contracts and build things on Fractal, because you'll eventually be able to then move that to Bitcoin mainnet. And it mirrors Bitcoin's code base. And so there's a lot of reasons to think that they're trying to be like the most Bitcoin aligned sidechain in existence. But again, you have to, it's a separate chain. It's not Bitcoin. It's not stored on Bitcoin. It doesn't inherit the security or decentralization of Bitcoin. It is a separate chain in its entirety. If you want to do Fractal.
It's not Bitcoin. It doesn't inherit Bitcoin security. I think this is really important to clarify that it's something different.
Right, and this goes back to the merged mining take from earlier. Like, yeah, you can bootstrap your hash rate by merge mining with Bitcoin, but you don't get the security or decentralization of Bitcoin. You just leverage some of the Bitcoin miners to increase your hash rate to make your chain harder to attack. So, like, you're leveraging the miners, but you don't get the security or decentralization of Bitcoin.
Yeah, you could argue that it increases Bitcoin miner revenue, which theoretically increases Bitcoin security in some capacity, but yeah, it's not the other way around, and that's an important marketing thing. Another component is so Cyphor, we should have him honestly if you want to do a deep dive. He's looked at it a bit. Cyphor looked through some stuff, and so first of all, the first epoch is Fractal is just skipped, and so we're launching day one when it goes to mainnet with a 50% pre-mine. So the 50 Bitcoin block reward, they are just adjusting the timing on the blocks so that day one, we begin at epoch two, kind of, or really epoch one, with a 25 Fractal Bitcoin block reward. And the halvings are every 2 years instead of four. Why? I'm not really sure. Is this going to be an airdrop? I don't know. Are these allocated for mining partners to launch with? I don't know. Cyphor, when he looked through the actual, like, they forked Bitcoin Core for a Fractal Bitcoin client, And he looked there, and his kind of initial takeaway, it looks like someone just kind of like went through and like slapped a bunch of the things they wanted and didn't like in core without like any consideration towards like whether this is a security concern or like why these things are in here. How do I put this again tactfully? There's a particular thing that Bitcoin SV developers do, and it looks a lot like that, where they just kind of come in, you give them a bunch of tools, and they throw all the tools at the wall, and something pops out. And that's a lot of what you see here. They failed to remove validation logic around edge cases of BIP 3034. You can remove valid transactions from the mempool forcibly with an RPC endpoint. There's all this weird stuff they was like looking through. I don't know. I don't even know if that matters, right? Does all this matter? Because like, if we're just saying that this is a merge mine sidechain and the goal is to spend out a shit ton of tokens and reinvigorate the BRC20 trend, then like, does it matter how it's designed? It's more just like, who's building it? Is it going to work? And do the degens want it? And I think
those what's the mission statement
are important.
Yeah. What's the mission statement? Is it tired of Bitcoin being a little too slow and kind of expensive sometimes? Well, check this out. We made Polkadot or Cosmos closer to Bitcoin for you guys to
talk about like adding other things besides just making block time faster. Like adding like different types of like programmability, or because it just makes the block, it's really just what it is. It just makes block time faster and juices the rewards.
Juices. Can we just connect Dogecoin to Bitcoin?
Dogecoin,
we
is
do that
with Litecoin, so it's kind of very similar in this capacity.
Cool. Charlie, if you could pick, oh yeah, Jake, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, it sounds like Fractal would be a pretty good testnet. Like ETH is a testnet, but now Fractal is a good testnet to try shit and then bring it back home. Real quick, is it actually proof of work? So like when you say miners, these aren't like staking miners.
Yeah.
These are like
proof of work
miners.
Proof of work. Yeah, proof of work.
Oh, that sounds like a terrible
idea. You have to hash against, you know, the Fractal block template. So yeah, you got to do that. It's going to look a lot like a Bitcoin block template, just faster.
So why, Jacob? Why is it a bad idea?
For proof of work, well, I don't know. It seems to me that proof of work is a zero-sum game in the sense that competing networks of sufficient size make both less secure. So, like, now you have – this is the whole ETH – like, you can't let ETH Classic get too big and not have Bitcoin be less secure just because it goes to its highest source of return. So now you have not just like competing network, but
Ethereum actually merged to proof of stake. I don't think 100% had to do with them being within liking proof of stake. I think it had to do with Ethereum understanding that proof of work is a fair way to launch a token, but you cannot win the proof of work game against Bitcoin, so you have to find a different consensus mechanism. They tried to brand it with other reasons, but I think that's really the big reason, which is pretty smart actually.
No, that's why people ask about that, and I'm like, it was totally logical for them to do that. They had to do that. Because the end game is that either ETH wins or Bitcoin wins, but one has to slowly die, or they're both like 50-50 just makes them both easily more attackable. It just doesn't make sense.
So from taking that and bringing in Shinobi terminology here, Shinobi would call Fractal a parasite chain. Parasite chain meaning trying to attract liquidity users, builders from Bitcoin in a way that is not synergistic with Bitcoin L1, in a way that is competitive to Bitcoin, Bitcoin's existence, the purpose and mission of Bitcoin. That's the more aggressive terminology. I think some people have said Remora chain as well, which is just a nicer way to say parasite. But that's the Shinobi terminology view of Fractal.
Although one thing I did see, and I don't know if this is true or not, but they said that because it's so closely aligned with Core and it tracks the same wallets, you can send whatever token standards are on Fractal to my Taproot address and then change networks and I won't see them until I move networks, but I'll have tokens hiding for me on Fractal. I don't know if that's true. That sounds kind of crazy, but if it is like that, that like you can take, a list of addresses that are holding Ninjas, for example, and then just airdrop to that exact wallet address. But then you say, hey, if you just change your network on Xverse and go to this website, you'll have a bunch of tokens waiting for you. It's a pretty works like that. It's a pretty crazy go to market.
Yeah. To be clear, that's not Bitcoin assets. You're not airdropping Bitcoin assets to Bitcoin addresses. You're airdropping Fractal assets to Bitcoin addresses. It's essentially you have a copy of your Bitcoin address on the Fractal side, which feels plausible to me. I don't actually know the details there, but it feels plausible.
I think you can sign with the same private key because it's both from the same elliptic curve.
Yeah.
But more importantly, BRC20 fork.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So,
Unisat is BRC20.
Someone's got to say it.
I would put an asterisk on that.
So they're not allowing 4 and 5 ticker deviations on Fractal. They're just expanding. They're extending the Fractal set. But if they want to bring that back to Bitcoin L1, that's where the friction happens.
Yep. So I mean, you'd have to upgrade
BRCs. They don't go back.
Say it again.
Well, no, you can only do 4 and 5 ticker BRC20s on Bitcoin, and you can only do 6-character+ tickers on Fractal. So if you want to try to take BRC20s from Bitcoin to Fractal, I think that works because they have the namespace reserved on the Fractal side. If you want to take Fractal assets back to Bitcoin as native BRC20s, you have to upgrade BRC20 directly in order to enable 6+ tickers, but you also have to say 6-character+ tickers can't be minted on Bitcoin L1. And that's a very committal Fractal takeover of BRC20 that lots of people are not going to like.
Well, luckily everybody hates anything that's over 4 letters anyway, so now they have a reason not to whine about that.
Well, pizza, man. Pizza. Five bytes. Big airdrop. Yeah.
I'm super mad about the Ruins 13-character ticker thing still, which I think is the best. I love it.
Aren't we due? I think we're due for the next drop down
or 12. Like, yeah,
a couple days.
It's the same problem. Actually, yeah.
It was like it was like 18 days ago. I think it's any day. It's surprising that no one's talking about it and trying to like front run good 12-letter ones. Maybe it's because that's still so long that no one gives a shit.
Yeah, they'll be talking when it comes up on 4, 5, maybe.
I actually wouldn't be shocked if it's already passed. I wouldn't be shocked if it's already passed.
Let's find out. Hang on. Bit of Luminex. Continue on. I'll report
it's
back.
It's super close.
Also, I looked up what a remora was, the fish that eats parasites off other fish. Just so you know. In case we were wondering where that reference comes from with parasites.
Yep. We're learning stuff. Not just Bitcoin tech stuff, but you get English.
It's a marine fish also. And there are non-marine fish. Marine fish are in oceans. Non-marine fish are in lakes. I didn't know this either. I just learned all that.
Wait, did it just happen? It was like August 19th?
That's what I'm saying. I put out a tweet saying it's 18 days from the 12-letter one, and it was a while ago. I checked the block time. So I think it already happened, and no one... There's no meta for 12 characters.
Bro, if I didn't notice, nobody noticed.
Yeah. Nobody's pushing 12 characters.
It says it on Luminex. It says minimum 12 characters in the etch box.
Wow. Cool.
You got the alpha here, folks. Go get your 12-character burn stickers.
Yeah, I did do a little bit of ChatGPT. I was like, all right, give me the coolest 12-letter blah, blah, blah. To try and like snag them early. I'm glad I didn't because nobody gives a shit until like at least we get to like 6.
Do you know the ticker this is 12 is 12 characters?
Nice.
I think I'm gonna etch it right now.
Do it.
Nice.
Do it.
That's funny.
Yeah, that's actually crazy though. So that probably means the next few epochs are gonna be just like trending to nothingness. Runes are for sure more dead now. one other degen angle is not being used by the degens, so
yeah.
We're down bad.
Damn, that's how bad I've been trying to like find a good metric for how bad runes are, and like Christ doesn't really reflect it very well anymore. This is a good one. I made another comment where I was going through my Dune dashboards, which I do at least weekly, and I noticed like nobody had rerun the Dune dashboards since the last time I did. I was like, this is indicative of like how bad the ecosystem is. So
it was 3 days for the other one, right? 3 days and like 7 days or something. It had been a long time.
Yep. All right. Next topic. We have like 15 minutes left. I may have a few topics we could touch on. BitVM2, Arch, or Opnet. I'm kind of more interested in Arch or BitVM2, but what should we touch on? I'm open. Is BitVM2 ever going to launch?
With Arch or BitVM2, but Bob is the first person. I'm pretty sure Bob is a ChatGPT language model to like immediately figure out how something works.
Yeah, do you train the model on your old tweet threads to be like, talk like me, give the alpha, and here's the docs?
I've tried a million ways to make content creation easy, and nothing works. It's basically... It requires 4 to 6 hours of Bob time, and that's the only way to do it. That's the only way it can be done. I've tried ghostwriters. I've tried AI. I've tried specialized AI models and custom fine-tuned AI models, and nothing works. So I just crank on the content side. It's the only way. On the BitVM2 side, the important thing to note is a lot of people pushing on BitVM right now. The BOB team, the Alpen Labs team, the Citria team, and I know there are others. I think BitLayer as well. They're pushing on the BitVM side. BitVM2 is great because it's significantly better than BitVM1. BitVM2 is not great because it's still fairly expensive and not user friendly and not practical for normal users. So what I mean by that is BitVM2, essentially the way it works, I'll give you like the 30-second rundown. You have some kind of signing committee. They all come together and they create this bridge. You're trusting one of them to keep their private material secret. So there's kind of a one of n trust assumption there. Then anyone can come and deposit Bitcoin into this bridge. The main limitation is it has to be a static amount. This is because you have to pre-sign all transactions. And so pre-signing every possible amount is just not very practical. So you pick an amount. It's likely going to be a high amount, like 1 Bitcoin or 5 Bitcoin or 10 Bitcoin. So people can come in, can deposit into the bridge, and then you can go and, you know, mint Bitcoin on some kind of L2. When you want to come back, you can have some kind of like proof of burn. You show that proof of burn to the operator and you say, hey, here's my proof of burn. The operator can validate everything. This can all be like off chain. And then the operator fronts you the money. So, you know, hey, I want to withdraw one Bitcoin or 10 Bitcoin or whatever. And the operator has to give you that money from their own sources. They give you the money and then they issue a reimbursement request directly to the bridge. So they say, hey, I just paid this out. Here's all the information. Here's my on-chain transaction. You know, this is my reimbursement request. Then anyone, you know, any verifier, which this is an open verifier network, so anyone can come in and issue a challenge. And they could say, hey, this is a bad withdrawal request. We know you didn't actually, you know, do any of this. This is not true. And, you know, you're trying to steal funds from the bridge. And then that starts a challenge response game where you essentially walk through this tap tree and prove your side of the story. If the operator is correct, then that's fine and it's all good and they get their Bitcoin. And if they're wrong, then I think there's some kind of like slashing, you know, that happens. So that's essentially the way BitVM2 works in a nutshell. One of the main limitations is this challenge response game is very expensive. We're talking like not in order to initiate a challenge, but in order to do the first step as the operator, it's like a full Bitcoin block worth of data that needs to be put on chain. So like, I don't know, 10 grand, 20 grand or something like that. And so to prevent random people from just griefing this operator, they have to put up collateral when they issue a challenge equal to the cost that the operator is going to have to pay in order to post that data on chain. And so there is a capital requirement for people to come in and issue a challenge. The nice thing is users can crowdsource that. So if there is some kind of like malicious thing, it probably makes sense for people to kind of rally around and get the collateral in order to issue the challenge. But again, it is very, very expensive. It's probably only three or four transactions back and forth, which is better than the 50 or 60 that it used to be, but it's still very, very big. So what Alpen Labs released this morning is they basically cut that in half. So rather than there being, you know, multiple Bitcoin blocks of challenge response, now they cut it in half. So it's still very expensive, but half as big as it used to be. That's Bibium.
Is that a new opcode TMOL, or is that something they've accomplished with existing opcodes to reproduce?
Yeah, I believe it's just they're emulating multiplication in a more efficient fashion.
Okay, gotcha.
That's my understanding.
I mean, I understand that, like what's funny is like I talked to the cat people, and they're like, well, the most obvious opcode after cat is mol, because multiplication is such an important, powerful tool.
Like, yep.
And
yep.
Yeah. So emulation of it efficiently is a huge tool.
Yep.
Interesting. I keep hearing like this cost thing keeps being one that I feel like people don't talk enough about on both the rollup side and the BitVM side. Like Babylon happened yesterday. That would shut down everything until Babylon chills out. And I don't know. I just feel like. Another point I'll make, and then we'll come back to that. But like something that people talk a lot about is, where's the long-term security going to come from? And I think we're getting glimpses of it. It's 1,000 Babylons in the sense that it's just micro use cases that establish a floor that slowly rises. Like runes aren't going to zero. Babylon's not going to zero. Rollups aren't going to go to zero. But as fees go to 1,000 steadily, like you have to have BitVM 7 for it to work.
I agree. Like, this is my whole thesis. This is why I have been just screaming from the rooftops, like, pay attention to fees. This is what everyone should be looking at. And the dynamics of, like, transactions and block inclusion. This is the frontier. And I think this is the epoch where we've actually flipped for a long, sustained period of time, maybe permanently, the subsidy versus reward. And I think it's really interesting. And a lot of people are like, well, Bitcoin's natural pricing will push these fee spikes down. And I'm like, yes, but I think as a base case, you assume that fees are extremely volatile indefinitely, and you have these crazy spikes. And it's difficult to like predict, but the average floor goes up by 3 or 4x. every period or so, because if you look at it, like right now we seem to have a fee floor of like 3 to 4 sats per Vbyte. As much as that is like still incredibly low, that's 300% higher than it was prior to ordinals. Do this a couple years in a row, and now we're looking at like 50 sats per Vbyte as a base. Is like, that's consolidation range with consistent spikes in the thousands. Like, this is not crazy, especially if you're looking at 1,000 Babylons, 1,000 rollups, and whatever other, like, your JPEGs have a clock ticking on them. Those 4 meggers, once this kicks off, those 4 meggers will be immortalized, and you will not be able to do those anymore. I get excited about this. I'm also talking my bags, but I do genuinely believe this is a, like, the window's closing, and you can see it. You can see glimpses of it.
Yep. 100%. What do you think is more likely, BitVM 2 live on mainnet, or they do BitVM 3 white paper and we just start the process all over again?
I think BitVM 2 is good enough for a specific bridging use case, and that is large liquidity providers that are basically just partners that are going to come in and put in chunks of 10 BTC each, and they're going to fund this bridge that is going to have one of N trust assumptions and, plus the operator liquidity trust assumption. But I think the operator is just going to have some liquidity sitting around that's just part of that partner LP fund, is it, essentially? And then liquidity providers know that there are some restrictions on the speed at which withdrawals can happen. So will we get a WBTC $10 billion locked in a BitVM2 bridge that, you know, users can go in and use? I don't think so. But could we get a bridge that's good enough, that has decent trust assumptions, and that is limited in like withdrawal capacity? It's basically like a, it's like a one of n trust assumption, but it's kind of like handshake trust assumptions around it that make it possible for LPs to actually come in and make it possible. And then you can have this Bitcoin on L2s that people can just do cross-chain swaps into. That's what I view as the future, the near-term future. And so I do think we get BitVM2 bridges in production with this kind of model that users will never touch, but that you will have Bitcoin that comes from a BitVM bridge that lives on L2s. That's my, and we're not going to get $10 billion in TVL in these bridges, but maybe $100 million, maybe $1 billion. That's my take.
Successful bridge with BitVM, and it's implemented and people are using it, like even if it has a low nine-figure TVL, that's significant. I would say that is incredibly successful. We're not even a year out from this idea even being, you know, put out there. So like, think of how dramatically that changed the landscape of what we consider to be possible with Bitcoin. So exciting. There could be like 10 other Robin Linuses out there right now, you know, in the workshopping process for like comparable white papers and ideas. So very exciting right now.
Yep, 100%. And I definitely agree, Bob. I think that's probably how it's going to play out. And you'll just do atomic swaps to the chain from retail, which is interesting because one of the pushbacks on Drive Change was the freaking counting mechanism for Pegout was like, it's just not usable for the average user. But they would just use it like exactly that same thing. You just do an atomic swap. Someone in the middle is acting like a market maker, and you're good to go. Interesting. All right, last topic. I want to go somewhat kind of like less technical, more philosophical, or just kind of like market. You had something, Donnie, in the chat about East versus West, different mindsets. Queued up, and then I want to just like briefly just touch on it.
Yeah, I think this happened back when someone was talking about Mesh Beetles a long time ago, and they were an NFT that was on Ethereum Classic that moved over, or moved a large portion of what they had over to Bitcoin. Like they were on the narrative that I was given anyway, which is it's difficult to even have conversations across East-West borders because the alphabet's not the same, and like every mode of communication is just more difficult when you're not using the same alphabet, right? So I'm sure I was speaking with a very small percentage of the population. But on the spaces where I was able to actually communicate with the people who were in the Mesh Beetles community, they said that they really liked Bitcoin and wanted to move to Bitcoin and stayed on Ethereum Classic, in fact, because moving to proof of stake would centralize things in a way that they had become, specifically Chinese people, had become wary of because of governmental trauma, I think. So the narrative that I had in my head, whether this is true or false, or maybe not representative of an entire population, was that the Chinese consumers or developers or whatever really liked Ethereum Classic because it was still proof of work. And they really liked Bitcoin way more because it was proof of work and fully decentralized. And it was like safe from governmental manipulation or power manipulation in a way, anyway. And all the developers of layer two solutions have been Chinese so far. And most of them have been leaning into proof of stake sidechains or somehow utilizing Bitcoin's proof of work security in just some weird way that initially my brain was like, isn't Bitcoin the solution? Like, why are we trying to turn Bitcoin in or pull Bitcoin users from Bitcoin into something that I, from my knowledge of the situation, was the less attractive to the Chinese population? And over the course of the last 3 hours that I've been thinking about this, I realized that it's probably just everyone trying to pull more people in and make a more secure place than the other proof-of-stake networks. But I really haven't formulated like a narrative that makes sense in my head. Maybe it's not ever going to, but it just seemed to raise a flag that the people I thought were super into proof-of-work were like, yeah, but how do we make it more proof-of-stake? Like, it just seemed like a weird dichotomy to me, you know?
I'm glad you brought this up, Donnie. I think you're directionally right, but some of the specifics I have a little bit of insight on Ethereum Classic specifically. Enough water's under the bridge that I feel like comfortable just saying this publicly, but like It was there was like a guy or two who had the line on the particular ASIC switch hash, like the Dagger Hashimoto, and so they really kind of strong armed the ETH Classic, like movement, and so I think it was very much more economics driven from a handful of actors. You see this with most proof of work cryptocurrencies, that it is downstream of who produces the rigs. You see this with CASPA happening right now. Spicy take, sorry CASPA guys. So. But my response to your like Chinese capital venture into proof of stake chains, I just think the Chinese are not as biased about ideology. They will deploy capital and build something overnight, which is a incredibly important cultural dynamic to have if we're in a highly iterative like tech space. So I think that's really valuable. I think Westerners tend to get too consumed with like doing things the right way. I myself like fall prey to that instead of just fucking shipping something and seeing if it works. So, yeah. That's my opinion of what's going on. Jake, I know you had on.
It's probably many things, but one thing I've been trying to figure out is in the fundraising space, you have the Western VCs and the Eastern VCs, and they invest very differently. And I was trying to understand why do the East invest the way they do it. They're very much token focused. They want shorter lockups, and they're going to dump the token earlier for like maybe a 20 or 50x. When in the East, it's like we're trying to find the next Meta or Facebook, and we're looking for that 1,000 or 10,000x. It's just a different paradigm, and they're willing to be equity and lock up for 10 years. And as far as I could grasp, the difference is that in the West, we have more freedom, and we have stronger IP rights. And in the East, you have this government that tells you what to do directionally, and IP rights are not really a thing. Like, once an idea comes true, everyone fast follows. And so this idea of like, haha, look how Facebook copied Snapchat for stories. Like, that's a dig at Mark Zuckerberg if you're in the West. It doesn't exist in the East. They do not care. It's just feast or famine, best idea goes first, and everyone fast copies and you iterate faster. So in that, because this idea of less property rights and you don't know when you might be rugged by the powers that be, it makes your window shorter. And so they're much more narrative based and cued into like vibes, and they watch the market much more closely, and retail is more of a thing on that side. We have huge institutional drivers here in the US that drive like 70% of the volume on any given day. Depending on the market you're in Asia, retail can be 50% to 60% of the market. And so narratives are much more dominant there. So it's something like that, which is that the benefit to going proof of stake is fast to market, launch, everyone does their things, you exit and you repeat. And it's just common there. So it's not like a negative. They just accept it as reality.
I can see that. That makes the most sense to me, Jay.
It's cool. It's cool to see the totally separate sides of the world. Although we're getting closer with modern communications and airplanes and all that stuff, they'll have these dramatically different ideologies. I've been saying for like 10 years maybe that every city in the US is going to feel like the same city soon. And it's starting to. Like accents, regional accents are kind of going away in metropolitan areas because everyone is always interacting like this. And the further out into the suburbs and rural areas you go, the more you have like very geographically segmented ways of operating. I like that we have such dramatically different ways of viewing the same ecosystem, because if we were all the same, we would just less cool stuff would happen because we would be running off in very few directions instead of like every direction at the same time. More explorative. So thanks for the insight.
Yep. And if I'm wrong, give me color. That's what I've been able to glean so far, but people in the comments, feel free to educate all of us.
I'll be in Singapore and I will report back on my second trip to Asia, where I will take to heart the purpose of trying to study what drives a particular Asian market cycle. Because I think for the next decade, that's like definitely we've got to pay attention to.
Learn Mandarin.
Jake, Donnie, either of you going to Singapore?
Nope. No. I'm landlocked for the rest of the year. Maybe I'll go to OpNext. That's my only one that I'm debating right now. But besides that, I got nothing on the radar.
I'll be in Asia all of November, I think, though. Just a variety of places, not for any conference or anything. But I will be over there, just not for the same purpose.
I won't give specifics, but we have a considerable number of BIP authors confirmed. So our goal is to get the majority of BIP authors for like the soft works that are in the conversation. So
love it. Okay, let's give a quick shill of Up Next. Give us the dates, and then we'll close this thing out.
Up Next, Boston, November 9th. Technical workshop heavy conference. We want to have a broad representation of people across the Bitcoin spectrum. But the purpose of the conference is to discuss and ideate what future soft forks look like. This is not a CAD conference, but CAD is like the thing on top of most people's minds. We are really hoping to get to be the place that everybody actually comes to talk about these things in the most neutral, inviting way. So
block space hosting,
no tokens, no booths, no sponsor, no speaker slots. It's a dev conference.
Love it. High signal. Cool. Talking about softworks and consensus.
Yeah.
Love it. All right. I think that's the pod. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.